Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. In 1864, as the Civil War was raging on and in the midst of some of its bloodiest battles, a couple of widely circulated New York newspapers published what today would be called fake news. It sent the Union and President Lincoln into a frenzy and arguably almost took both of them down. In response, Lincoln sent troops to arrest the editors. Fast forward to 2020, and a recent Gallup poll shows that more than 4 out of every 5 Americans say that news organizations advocate political viewpoints rather than report the news free of bias, and more than 8 in 10 Americans say the media bears at least a moderate amount of blame for the political divisions in the country. Yet, going by this Lincoln-era story, the so-called era of fake news is nothing new. Joining us now to bring us this story from history and talk about how we're seeing it play out today is Elizabeth Mitchell. Her book is Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. Elizabeth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation. If you have a question for our guest on this episode from the Lincoln presidency in her latest book, give us a call. Our lines are open at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can always tweet us at 21st Show. You know, Elizabeth, before we get into your book, we just finished talking about the vice presidential debate from last night, and I do want to ask you if you can talk about something that came up in the debate last night, because there was this so-called history lesson from Senator Kamala Harris on President Lincoln. Instead of me describing it, let's just listen to a clip.
If Judge Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States, are you and Joe Biden, if somehow you win this election, going to pack the Supreme Court to get your way?
I'm so glad we went through a little history lesson. Let's do that a little more. In 1864...
Well, I'd like you to answer the question.
No, Mr. Yes, Vice President, I'm speaking. Okay. In 1864, one of the, I think, political heroes, certainly of the president, I assume of you also, Mr. Vice President, is Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln was up for re-election, and it was 27 days before the election, and a seat became open on the United States Supreme Court. Abraham Lincoln's party was in charge not only of the White House, but the Senate. But Honest Abe said, it's not the right thing to do. The American people deserve to make the decision about who will be the next president of the United States, and then that person can select who will serve for a lifetime on the highest court of our land.
So President Lincoln foregoing an appointment of a Supreme Court justice before his re-election in 1864. This is kind of contemporaneous with the era in your book. I wonder, did you encounter anything on this in your research, or are you able to fact check this a little bit for us?
Sure. I mean, first of all, it was amazing to me to hear 1864 come up in the debate because it's the year that's the focus of my book. So it's sort of extraordinary. But this is correct that, you know, Lincoln had this opportunity to make an appointment, but didn't. But there are a few other factors involved. And one is, first of all, one thing I would point out is that the Supreme Court wasn't really a politicized body in the way it is today. So it wasn't as if he thought, oh, if I get somebody in there, they can push my agenda. It was more who was the most respected legal mind in the country. And so it's a different atmosphere to start. The other thing is he was quite distracted because the war was raging. It was not clear, you know, what was going to happen in the election. And he did say he was going to solicit the American people's opinion. That's taken to mean not necessarily their opinion through the vote, but more through them sending in letters, nominating various people. And in the end, he nominated his former Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon Chase, who had been kind of a rival of his for the Republican nomination. And it was somewhat considered a way to appease Salmon Chase when he had accepted his resignation back in June.
Interesting. So 1864.
So somewhat correct. Yeah.
somewhat correct. Well, isn't that basically the catch-all fact check for everything?
Yes, exactly.
Somewhat correct. All right, let's turn to your book. It's called Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. Let's start from a very basic premise. What was Lincoln's lie?
Well, the interesting thing, and when I'm telling the story and in my research, is that Lincoln tells a number of lies, actually, through his presidency. Some are, you know, little white lies, and some are more significant. And so one of the things that you come across is that in this particular incident of fake news, he reacts with the most anger that, you know, witnesses had seen him respond to any event in his presidency, apparently. And he orders this immediate arrest of the newspaper editors and the shutting down of these newspaper offices. So you had armed guards in these offices, these major New York papers, for several days. The interesting thing, and I don't want to give away everything because, you know, I did write the book in a way hoping that people would get the kind of intrigue that I experienced when I was doing the research. But
no spoilers.
Actually,
we will try.
I know,
no,
but I will say this: it might not have been fake news. So his position, you know, his extreme reaction, is potentially even a cover up.
So can you describe for listeners what actually set him off? What got him so angry? Right.
So the background is basically, you know, and I find it really interesting, the scene of, you know, what happened, which is that at, you know, 3 a.m, you know, a 17-year-old boy is running through the streets of New York, all going up and down the newspaper row to deliver this proclamation. It's supposedly an Associated Press paper, the same handwriting as the Associated Press, and he delivers it to these newspaper offices when the editors have all gone for the day, but there's still a printer on hand, and the printer sees it, sees that there's this proclamation from Abraham Lincoln saying, we're, you know, the war is going terribly, we, you know, why are we the sufferers of our century, we must all basically pray and fast to make amends, and I would need 400,000 more men to go to the front, and if I don't get them through volunteerism, I'm going to set a draft immediately. So these printers decide that they've got to run the story, because if they don't, they'll look like they're taking a political position. And so 2 of the papers run it. There were others that were closer together so they could communicate more directly about what they thought this announcement was. But these 2 were the ones who ran it, and it caused a huge ruckus in New York. There was, and then beyond that, you know, there was, gold went skyrocketing on Wall Street. People were gathering in the streets to fight and, you know, and worry about what was going to happen next. And the most significant thing was that there was a boat that was about to go to Europe carrying the news of the Union. And both France and England were sort of anxious to recognize the Confederacy. They thought it'd be easier for business. And so they were about to get this information that would make them think the Union was over. So there was a lot at stake.
In the context here, these are not the New York draft riots when people talk about that. I think that was 1863, if I'm correct about that. But I mean, that is the backdrop. I mean, that had happened in New York. That was there. So there was this palpable anger. Already sort of like set to go, right?
Yeah, I mean, no one wanted to repeat the draft riots. We have a sense of it from, you know, Gangs of New York and movies like that. But the reality was, it was one of the most brutal incidents of our history. There were basically raging mobs running through the streets of New York for 5 days. They were basically white people. They killed, you know, something in the order of 175 black people by lynching, mutilation, etc. They set fire to all sorts of buildings. They, you know, it was horrible. And basically, the only thing that stopped them, the police were helpless, but the military had to come up from the front lines to quiet it. So that was the backdrop. People were afraid what the response would be if another draft came right at that moment.
And so you began, you mentioned a little while ago, I should say we need to take a break in about a minute and a half here, but you mentioned a little while ago that President Lincoln was as angry as anyone had ever seen him. What was sort of the result of that? What did he send in? You can just talk a little bit about, you know, sending in people to arrest the publishers and mm-hmm. stop the presses, I guess.
Yes. It was a big deal in terms of it, you know, it would be like if, you know, suddenly NBC or, you know, CNN were under right. guard. And, you know, I mean, it's a traumatic experience for the general public. And so it actually created a constitutional crisis. There were calls for Lincoln's impeachment, for, you know, his suppression of free speech, of, you know, taking a private operation militarily without any kind of trial ahead of time. So, but the other thing he did, which, you know, was he shut down the telegraph throughout the country, and that was their internet. I mean, at that point, it was so ubiquitous, people would, you know, change their plans even within a day. Like, we're not going to have dinner, we're going to go to the opera, you know, that kind of thing would be communicated. So this was suddenly the shutdown of the wire services throughout the East Coast, certainly, and going out towards the West. Mm-hmm. So it was strong reaction.
Yeah. All right, we need to take a break. We are speaking with Elizabeth Mitchell, who is the author of Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. We're going to have more of our conversation. The phone lines are open. If you have a question, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. More to come in just a moment. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with author Elizabeth Mitchell about her new book, Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. And we were, before the break, we were talking about President Lincoln's reaction to a set of stories that, I guess we'll leave it at, may or may not be fake news, that he was looking to, draft hundreds of thousands of more people into the Union Army during one of the bloodiest periods of the Civil War. Let's take a step back. I'm curious, what made you want to write this story, right? In Springfield, there's a, you know, it's, I think it's a, I don't know if this is true or a cliche, but Lincoln is one of the most, written about people in history. And I know in Springfield, there's a bookstore right next to the old state capitol where Lincoln gave his famous House Divided speech, and it has just a wall of Civil War and Lincoln books. So I'm curious about that seems like a brave step.
No, absolutely. I mean, even when I was proposing this to the publishers, I said, I cannot make the case that he hasn't been written about. I mean, he's probably the most written about figure in all of American history. And once you write about him, you understand why. I mean, I could now spend the rest of my life, you know, studying him. And so, and I have to say, it's very exciting to be on your show, because now I have such, you know, I'm so attached to your area. But what happened was, I was working on another book, the book that preceded this, which was called Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty. And in that book, I had recognized from finding a diary of the artist who made the statue that the statue wasn't actually what I had always assumed, you know, just this gift from the French government to the American government, but it was actually this artist who had no support and came over here knowing no one, just with the idea that he wanted to make this colossus. And so it was such a fantastic, intriguing story. It occupied me for a couple of years. When I was researching that, the newspaper, The World, was the one that Joseph Pulitzer used to promote the Liberty fundraising. And he had bought that paper at a cut rate price. And it said, because of this scandal in 1864, the paper had been so discredited that they could never, you know, get themselves quite back on their feet. It said the part about Lincoln's reaction, it was about this fake news. And that so surprised me, because, you know, of course, like most Americans, you know, I've revered Abraham Lincoln, and certainly, and, you know, it's his courage in the circumstance that he was in has been so crucial. But I hadn't understood that he had some issues with, say, you know, habeas corpus. I knew that one actually, but I mean, I didn't know his freedom of speech stuff was so prickly. So I started looking into it. And then when I was looking into it, it got richer and richer. It was not only the resonances with where we are today. I mean, across the board, you know, I already talked about the telegraph and, you know, its relation to the internet, but it's also, you know, the way the media was divided up, you know, some of the characters that were part of it, Wall Street, what it was doing during this time, the partisan divide, on and on. And so it became really quite fascinating. And then also every time I would research and think I'd found the culprit, there would be this reversal where I'd find something new, you know, so it's really a fascinating story. And then there's that part where once you come across a story like that, just as a writer, I was excited at the idea of writing it in that kind of whodunit mode, because there is that element when you're writing a book, you kind of really want to delight your readers, I guess. And so this story fascinated me, and I hoped I conveyed it.
Yeah, and you talked about the partisan press at the time, and mm-hmm. I know in Springfield there was the Journal newspaper and the Register newspaper, and the Journal was Lincoln's friend and the Register was his avowed enemy. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've come to hear this term in the last few years of fake news. Mm-hmm. It's in the subtitle of your book, but I'm guessing that was not what politicians used back then. But how did they talk about reporting and journalism that they didn't like?
Well, an interesting thing is that on, for example, stories from the front, the Civil War front, they would put a slug above it that would say, "This is interesting if true." And everyone just was fine with that, you know, because all they wanted was some information from the front. And they, as, you know, mature readers could say, okay, that's probably somewhat true, or I need to check other sources or what have you. I think people were more comfortable with the idea that they were getting information that, you know, it's generated by humans, and, you know, humans are complex people, complex entities. You know, they have, the story has to do with how many sources you have and who your sources are and what their agenda is. And so newspaper, I love reporters. I think that journalists are some of the bravest, most extraordinary servants of our society. But I also think that you have to, at some points, use your judgment and sift out what you think has a little bit of spin on it. And that doesn't mean it's completely to be discounted, but you need to sort of have a, you know, the same kind of wisdom you bring into, you know, buying a car or what have you. You don't just take the first pitch. So in any case, there was a lot of, there were actually a lot of hoax stories that were circulating even before this. One of the most famous is the moon hoax story, which was the New York Sun ran 6 days of stories that were scientific in nature about the fact that this particular well-known scientist had found, with his telescope, had seen cavorting animals on the moon, unicorns and, you know, frolicking little beasts, kind of Dr. Seuss characters, and everyone went for it. They loved it. So there was a kind of somewhat whimsical, let's say, somewhat dangerous, you know, tendency to run these hoax stories. We don't have them on that level now. If they exist, they're for very partisan, you know, reasons.
Yeah. Well, let's try and bridge to the now a little bit with this idea of fake news. Early on in the book, you point out in the run-up to the 1860 election that Lincoln actually secretly purchased a German language newspaper, the Illinois, yes, Staatsanzeiger. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but it, realizing he needed to win the German-American vote in order to win the election. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like today if, you know, Joe Biden or Donald Trump bought a major media outlet. Obviously, that'd be a pretty big scandal. Can you talk a little bit about that and how the dynamics have changed there?
Well, I mean, I think that's Harold Holzer is where, you know, is the person who originally uncovered that, you know, at least to my research. And it's so interesting because it's a secret contract. He drew it up, and, you know, and it shows such savvy, I mean, in terms of wanting that particular vote. This is not the clodhopper, you know, that kind of crack on Lincoln. This was someone who really knew how to play the media. So, you know, there's that. And he continues with this sort of thing as he goes on. You know, at one point, his White House staffers are writing anonymous stories reporting on goings on in D.C., but it's put off as if it's, you know, just a regular journalist. But, you know, we have similar situations in as much as, for example, the relationship between David Pecker, who was a former employer of mine, and Donald Trump. You know, that that relationship was, you know, Trump, you know, using money, you know, funneling money through to, you know, pay off people he wanted paid off, essentially. There's, you know, there are some similarities in these ways. But I think, you know, rightfully, there would be, if it came about somebody had actually purchased a paper or something, I think the public would have a huge outcry. Of course, in Lincoln's time, they didn't have the benefit of knowing this. We found this out in the, you know, by studying the archives.
You know, so, I mean, today you would, I guess, the politicians maybe don't have to buy a newspaper or a cable television news outlet outright to get that sort of influence. The book is about Lincoln, but it's also about the media as a whole,
yeah.
Right? And I mentioned it in the introduction to our conversation, the statistic from Gallup on American distrust in the media. 4 in 5 Americans say that they think the media advocates political viewpoints rather than reporting the news free of bias. I mean, you mentioned a little bit about sort of people having an understanding of the sort of like, whoa, if true, way to read the news mm-hmm. from the Civil War front. Can you talk? I mean, was that trust in the media better or worse or just different in Lincoln's time?
Well, one thing was that it was actually more partisan back then. And so people knew what they were getting, you know, in as much as the, you know, Henry Raymond, for example, was at the Times was very much a Lincoln supporter. He became a Lincoln supporter and, you know, he was a big player in the party as well. Most of the editors sort of had declared their allegiances outright and then the news would follow that. I think that, you know, first of all, I think, you know, Trump has done some real damage. He's doing it just to, you know, sort of have an enemy he can fight against. You know, I don't even know that he believes what he says when he says fake news about certain outlets. For example, I went back and tracked how many times he calls CNN fake news and slams them. And then you look at his other tweets and he's thanking them for running his, you know, his live events or giving them a shout out for something that they did that was a direct cover, you know, directly covering him. So he sort of plays that card when he doesn't like what they're reporting. I think that so I think some of that has been drummed up, and I think one day we'll get over that. I think people will start to remember why they trust journalists, because here's the thing: nobody's out there really giving the speech for journalists. But most of the things that, you know, everyone's life has been affected by journalism in terms of, you know, reporting on the scandal of, you know, money embezzled in political scenes, or, you know, environmental issues where your water is in, you know, not good or what have you. And we probably need a little bit more advocacy of, you know, the ways in which journalism touches your life every day.
And in fact, you dedicate the book to all reporters, past and present, who witness.
Yeah.
You know, we're coming to the end of our conversation. And before I let you go, I can't let you go without asking about George, if I can, the late Political magazine where you were for several years executive editor. I still miss George. I have friends who still talk about it from time to time. Can you first just briefly describe George for people who might not have read it back in the day?
Sure. And that's so nice to hear from you, I have to say. So George Magazine was a political magazine started by John Kennedy Jr. And his idea was that it wasn't helpful to people to only hear from actually it was postpartisan. I mean, it really would be necessary today. His idea was to cover politicians in, you know, across the spectrum and basically look at them as, you know, what did they promise? Are they true to the promises? What motivates them? You know, what are their foibles? And and it was just an incredible experience. And it was so interesting how it opened up politics to people who hadn't been very active before. I mean, particularly female readers. We aimed to have half and half, female, male. There had never been a political magazine that had that kind of skew. And we got there. And even today, so many of the players that we covered are important now. I mean, Kellyanne Conway was somebody who used to stop by the George offices. You know, there was, all of them. Biden was, we were covering, et cetera. I just think John would have been very interested in covering this particular moment.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Elizabeth Mitchell is an author. Her latest book is out this week. It's called Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. Elizabeth, thanks so much for being on with us today on the 21st.
It was really lovely to be here. Thank you.
Listeners, we have a couple of notes at the end of the show today. We had planned to bring you an interview with writer and disability rights activist Melissa Blake, but unfortunately, we ran out of time today. We look forward to bringing you that interview next week so we can give the conversation with Melissa the time it deserves. Another note that on yesterday's show, we talked about the flu vaccine, and we got a lot of great calls from listeners. One listener in Sterling asked about the special high-dose flu vaccine for senior citizens and whether there was a shortage. Our guests weren't aware of a particular vaccine shortage in their area, but we did reach out to Carl in Champaign-Urbana, and they did say there is a nationwide shortage. Carl has a very limited supply of the high-dose flu vaccine to those 65 and older. Carl encourages patients to get a regular flu vaccine if the high dose is unavailable. And so that is all the time we have for today. If you did want to listen to that conversation about the flu vaccine, you can find that and everything else we talked about on our website at 21stshow.org. We're also available as a podcast. You can find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan is our engagement producer, and our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Briel Skullark, and Chantal Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk to you next week.